Because Molly O'Neill's foodie friends talked a lot about the death of American home cooking, she decided to see for herself if it was true. Her latest book, One Big Table, A Portrait of American Cooking, traces her culinary journey across America and includes 600 recipes from some of the nation's best cooks. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm pleased that it brings multiple Beard Award winner Molly O'Neill to our show today. Welcome back.
Nice to be here.
And Molly, you know, if you need to do some exercise, you can just pick up this book every once in a while. This is this weighs more than some of the weights I have in my house.
5.4.
5.4 pounds?
Yeah. We did a birth announcement. It's a book, 5.4 pounds.
The book represents a 10-year-long effort. Did you know it was going to take so long when you began?
I knew it was an ambitious book. I didn't know it would take 10 years. I only, the last 4 years were absolutely obsessively full-time. But before that, the 6 years before then, I was doing a lot of reading and travel and speaking and gathering in that way. The other thing that happened, Lenny, is that eating in America has changed radically over the past 10 years. I thought I knew what I was doing when I went out, and then the world changed.
So what you were discovering 10 years ago no longer applies in many cases?
In many cases.
Is that because we've changed our attitudes about food? We've had the locavore movement, and there's all the popularity of all those TV shows, and we have green markets popping up all over the country. Around 10 years ago?
It was around, but it was more fringe. It hadn't really exploded, particularly among the youth. And we're seeing more and more of that explosion. But while there's this gigantic consciousness raising going on with agriculture, at the same time, we're having a huge cultural shift. Our immigration patterns have shifted radically. And what we call community has been redefined. And so the Thai recipe that was fantastic 10 years ago, today is, degalas. It's a hybrid, and we can do much better.
I remember when everybody I knew thought mushu pork was the hippest thing in the world. Now it's the kind of thing you don't even find in a really serious Chinese restaurant.
We're dating ourselves.
In one of your previous books, the New York Cookbook, you take on a similar project, compiling recipes from all over the city. Aside from expanding the geography, what's different about this book?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I'm older.
You know more about food.
I've been doing this longer. With the New York Cookbook, I really did walk most blocks of all five boroughs. I could no longer do that, and you can't walk America. There is a vastly different geographical thing going on that I underestimated when I went out.
And in New York, you also asked friends and people you knew who you knew were interested in food for mm-hmm. recipes. You can't just do that. You just don't walk into Des Moines, Iowa, or your home. Well, you could do your hometown, Columbus, Ohio. You probably know some people there. But you can't walk into many places and simply say, well, who's the best cook in this town?
Unless you want to be locked up, you know. you're right. I mean, the gathering devices that I had to create were really challenging. I mean, the first thing that I did was I realized that although my natural constituency came from the years I was at the New York Times, that was just a small segment of the total picture of America. So I created Potlucks to End Hunger and did that for about 18 months with America's Second Harvest, now known as Feeding America. And those were amazing experiences.
Are we seeing a big divide similar to what we're seeing in politics, where the rumors that you heard that home cooking was a dying culture in America are true in some cases, but the opposite is also true, that home cooking is experiencing a revival?
One of the things that I learned about America is that everything is true and untrue. We're just this nation of constant contradictions. Is there a divide? Yes. Is it a new divide? No. We're more conscious of the divide, and food is being used I think, in a much more dramatic and at the same time insidious marker as a class distinction. And that's one of my concerns about where we are today.
A class distinction in what way?
Well,
wealthier people tend to eat out more, don't they?
Not necessarily.
And the old idea was that people who lived in cities were living quicker lives, so they were more likely to eat take home or take out or pre-prepared foods, whereas people in rural areas were more likely to have the big home cooked meal.
That's changed. One of the most dramatic changes is the exurbanization of recent immigrant cultures. I'm not seeing the recent immigrant cultures exclusively focused in metropolitan areas. We're seeing much more suburbanization, and that's changing the eating map of America.
But you come to the conclusion that the rumor that Americans aren't cooking is really just a newer version of the old claim that Americans can't cook.
Yeah, I think so. And I also think that it's one perpetuated by the food industry. If we can keep people believing that nobody cooks, then it becomes okay not to cook and it becomes okay to buy packaged foods and things like that.
But is part of one of the reasons for this rumor that unlike the French, Italians, Chinese, we can go down a long list, we don't have a true national cuisine, but rather a lot of variations on other people's cuisines?
I think that is true today. We're a culture in search of its cuisine, and we're getting closer and closer. The last 10 years has been a gigantic leap forward. But we're a young culture. Cuisines develop over thousands of years, not a couple hundred.
So you write that you were searching for true American cooking, and yet here you've included recipes for everything from tacos to Persian noodle soup, which would suggest that that's all American cooking.
I think you're right. At least that was my feeling when I finished that. The old metaphor was that American cuisine is a melting pot. America itself is a melting pot. Today, it's more a toss salad, where instead of everything going into one big pot and coming out sort of tasting the same, we're seeing much more diversity and distinction and cuisines entering our cuisine but remaining distinct.
Are there any foods that are strictly American?
Not that I found.
The hamburger goes back to Germany, we might say, and the hot dog. Pizza, of course, goes back to Italy.
But nobody in Italy is making tater tot casserole, so we could claim that.
Should we be claiming that?
I'm not sure we want to.
What about those old Jell-O molds?
Those are strictly American, but they were knockoffs of molded aspics and so forth.
You also make a distinction between American cooking and cuisine. What's the difference there?
To me, a cuisine has a body of codified recipes, and cooking is the day-to-day, always moving activity of making dinner and sharing food. And cuisine is more something you could put in a menu, in a book, or in a museum. Cooking is something of the minute. And you capture a minute in time, a moment, a place, a mood.
My guest is Molly O'Neill, who used to be a restaurant critic at Newsday and then wrote about food at the New York Times and has written a number of cookbooks. Her most recent one, One Big Table, it's one big book, A Portrait of American Cooking, 600 recipes from, she says, the nation's best home cooks, farmers, fishermen, pitmasters, and chefs. And it's published by Simon & Schuster. And you did go everywhere. You spoke to professional chefs, home cooks, fishermen, farmers, celebrities like Nora Ephron. I assume you knew that she could cook because she always includes recipes in her books. But how did you find the others?
Oh, in a number of ways. The potluck dinners that I did across the nation led me to a lot of cooks who I would not have otherwise met.
People said, you got to meet this woman. She's mm-hmm. really a great cook.
Yes.
Or this guy.
Exactly. And there are more and more guys. Ethnic clubs, churches, specialty food organizations, the edible magazines, the slow food chapters across America, the American Institute of Wine and Food, regional publications, and one of the greatest resources of all times, retired home economists and small town newspaper food columnists.
How often does the town folklore pan out, where somebody says, you've got to have Mrs. Smith's cherry pie, it's the best in the world?
I mean, food and cooking are kind of like baseball. If you're batting,
I'm getting
400, you get to the Hall of Fame.
At least in some towns, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you bat 400, you're doing great.
Yeah, exactly. So that means, you know, what, 2 out of 4 maybe, or, you know, 1.5, 1 out of 4 really pans out.
You were born and raised in Columbus, Ohio. It's a college town, but a lot of farms nearby. Do you, was there a lot of home cooking there?
Oh, there was a ton of home cooking when I was growing up. But one of the things that tickles me today is that I could not wait to get out of Columbus. You know, the movie Goodbye Columbus came out when I was a senior in high school, and that became my theme song. And what I wanted to leave behind was the kind of homeliness and the homemade and the farmed and the funky, and I just couldn't wait to get to something more polished and urbane. And now when you walk down the streets of Manhattan, there are all these little restaurants that look like the restaurants in Columbus when I was growing up. Everybody wants to be seasonal and farm this. And
well, actually, that came from Brooklyn into Manhattan.
There you go.
Your brother, when he was playing for the Yankees, there was always concerns that he was uncomfortable in the big city. Is he more comfortable now because of this? And does Paul cook?
Paul's a fantastic cook, and he's more than comfortable in the city. He fell in love with New York and fell in love with the Yankees and can't wait to get back here every time he comes back here just to eat.
Now, there are 600 recipes in this book. I'm assuming that you had a lot more that you had to test.
The initial manuscript had 1,200 recipes.
Twice as many.
Yeah. It was supposed to have 200 black and white photographs, and the publisher looked at the manuscript and said, oh, we should cut the recipes in half and quadruple the photographs and make them color. So about this time last year, that's what we were talking about.
Well, I'm assuming you you may have been sorry to see some of those recipes go, but color photographs really do help the home cook. You get a real sense of what the dish should look like.
Yeah, yeah. I at first I was opposed, but the publisher was absolutely right, and it made a blast, you know?
In the inside cover of the book, you've included an agricultural map of the United States. Did you find that terroir, that the concept of the French, affected what people were eating in specific regions?
It still does, both agricultural and cultural terroir. And I think, you know, our next big chapter will be combining the two of those.
Because we still identify certain foods with certain cities, mm-hmm. The Creole style of cooking with New Orleans. I don't know whether Philadelphia just wants to be known for its cheesesteak or Chicago for its deep dish pizza, but those are the foods that first come to mind when we think of those cities.
They are. And more we're seeing
Rice-A-Roni in
San Francisco.
Was that just a commercial?
No, it was hysterical. Some of the Persian people I interviewed would say, you know, we only have contributed one thing to American cuisine, and that's Rice-A-Roni. And I was shocked because I thought it was Italian, but in fact it wasn't. And I loved that story.
So Rice-A-Roni is adapted from Iranian food?
Yes, yes. It is to adapt. It's a pilaf.
You try to puncture a number of food myths in your book. Were there any that you were particularly surprised by?
That's a great question. Well, Rice-A-Roni was right up there. and that we don't really own hot dogs and we don't really own hamburgers. Those were certainly very, very interesting.
Did you find variations depending on the cultures that people came from? We once did a food swap, a recipe swap before Thanksgiving with Michael LaMonaco, and a listener sent in recipes. And it was fascinating because they not only were – everybody had a different dish, but they also reflected the cultures they'd come from. And the turkey that won was from somebody who had grown up in India. And it was a fabulous turkey, but it was both American and it was Indian.
That's a fabulous idea.
So I'm assuming you found some of those
tons of that. You know, the first kimchi hot dog I had was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and that was, you know, I think 15 years ago. And I thought, oh my God, the world is, you know, this is a seismic event, and what will we do? Kimchi on hot dogs, and now of course they're on half street corners in the United States.
And you discovered that cream cheese doesn't come from Philadelphia?
No. Cream cheese comes from upstate New York, but Philadelphia meant elegant in the days that cheese was first invented. It was a rift on Neuchâtel, and it came out of that little dairy belt about halfway up the Hudson River.
You had to test all of these recipes.
I did. I made them, and other people tested them. I'm the world's worst test cook. I'm a great cook, but I'm not very good at following recipes. So that's
because you throw in a bit more of this and a little less of that if you're inspired to do it that way?
That I cook from my senses, and I'm also constitutionally incapable of following directions, so that's not a very good recipe tester.
Well, do you actually recently we spoke to Ina Garten, and I asked her about all the different cookbooks she has, and she said she has a lot, but she cooks mostly from her own.
That's funny. That's really funny.
What about you?
Well, I cook
are there
from
any
books.
Recipes that you're particularly fond of in here?
Yeah. Yeah, there really are. But I tend to read a book and then it settles in my mind someplace and then I see a Brussels sprout and decide that I should do a chiffonade and stir fry them. I don't even remember where I got the idea half the time.
Well, it's always interesting when we come upon a food for the first time and think that it was invented. I had a dish in Florence. And I was all excited about it. It was kind of like a creme brulee as an appetizer, not as a dessert. And then I came back here, and about a week later, somebody sent me something by email in a similar recipe. And then I looked on the internet and discovered that restaurants are making it all over the world. And I thought this guy in Florence invented it.
That's very. What did he do the crackling part with?
With the Parmesan.
Nice.
Oh, it was fabulous.
Was it delicious?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Mm. I much prefer that to the sugar.
I'm a
Pane Vino in Florence, a wonderful restaurant, by the way.
Fantastic.
But I suspect that that's something that you ran across too. Somebody said, well, we invented this.
Oh, gosh, that happened all the time. And I had to be very careful and needed a lot of help in looking at all the recipes. People really do believe that we invented this or this was my grandmother's. And a really sharp food historian says, was her grandmother Betty Crocker?
Well, yeah, I know my cousin learned how to cook from Matchbooks with Del Monte used to have those recipes.
That's great.
She's since gotten a lot better. But, I mean, you got to start somewhere. By the way, if you want to start with some of the recipes in this book, we have posted some on our website, including the Saffron King's Persian Kebabs, Peter Nguyen's Saigon Biloxi Shrimp, and Helena Litke Longhofer's Midday Chicken.
Oh, that's a good recipe.
Those are all good?
Mm, they're all good.
And there are 597 other ones in this book, One Big Table, A Portrait of American Cooking, 600 recipes from the nation's best home cooks, farmers, fishermen, pitmasters, and chefs, published by Simon & Schuster with lots of pictures. And I thank you so much, Molly O'Neill, for being with us again.
Thank you. Happy holidays.